education and dedication. With collaboration, it's about inspiration.
Welcome to Teacher Talk. On this show, we discuss education policies, challenges in the classroom, and we invite special guests to look back over their school age years and to give their input on education policies today. Callers are provided anonymity, and by that I mean you do not have to identify yourself, others, or your location. Let's get started. This is Teacher Talk.
Telling you that when it comes to online charter schools, the national statistics tend to point to the fact that there is a lower percentage of free and reduced lunch students. There's a lower percentage of special needs students, students with IEPs. There's a lower percentage of English as a second language student. And there tends to be a higher percentage of gifted students.
On the phone is Dr. Michael Barber. His research in virtual learning is extensive, and he points out differences that are significant in student populations. Fewer IEPs, fewer free and reduced lunch, and fewer English learners. And to be clear, we are not discussing private school.
The studies that we've seen out there from the ones that I've been involved with the National Education Policy Center, to ones conducted by the Credo Group out of Stanford, just about every empirical study that's been done by an independent group of researchers has found that online charter schools, by and large, perform rather poorly compared to both brick-and-mortar charter schools and traditional brick-and-mortar schools.
Educators are not surprised at these online learning outcomes. Research indicates overall students perform higher having a teacher inside the classroom. Not all students want to be sitting in a classroom, your traditional classroom, particularly students that get caught up in the school-to-prison pipeline. Yes, I said it, it's very real. School-to-incarceration is a problem. More options are needed.
Well, when we're looking at the full-time programs, actually the majority of students enrolled in full-time online programs actually come from the elementary and middle school grades. When you're looking at the supplemental, it's almost all high school with some middle school and just a touch of elementary in there. So it depends on the form of online learning you're looking at.
I've been voicing concern about needed options for youth that may not be performing at the level required, not on a track to go to a university, perhaps not even on a track to graduate high school. Is online learning reaching a population of students that need alternative learning?
To answer your direct question, I'd say probably not. Is it actually reaching them? In most cases, it isn't, largely in part because the vast majority of at least full-time students are attending one of the cyber charter schools that are often run by for-profit corporations. That's not to say that it can't, and that's not to say that it isn't having an effect in isolated areas. You know, I could give you dozens of examples across the country of jurisdictions that have used both online charter schools and just, you know, regular district-based online programs to reach out to a population that isn't being served in the traditional classroom. One example that I use quite frequently is St. Clair County's Regional Educational Services Agency in Michigan. They have a virtual learning academy, and when they first set it up, they had a population of students, many of which were involved with the juvenile justice system, that had a legal requirement that they had to be in school, but in many cases these students had been permanently excluded or expelled from many of the brick-and-mortar schools in the district, and you know, they just simply weren't able to leave the district and go to another school because it's not necessarily in an urban area. So what the RESA, the Regional Educational Service Agency, decided to do was they looked at this specific population and started asking questions about, you know, what are the needs of these students? You know, how can we design a program of education that is going to cater to the specific needs that these students have? end, they ended up with an online program that has some face-to-face component. So all of the instruction is done online. They selected a curriculum vendor and who also came with a learning management system that they liked. They have a physical building that's, at least when it was first opened, was available to the students from 8 in the morning till 8 in the evening, Monday through Thursday, and from 8 to 4 on Friday and Saturday. Instead of enrolling them in 4 or 5 courses a semester like you traditionally have, mm-hmm. the students were only enrolled in 2 at a time. So the flexibility of the program and looking at, removing the dividing the attention over 4 or 5 courses, little things like that really provided an opportunity for these students. And it's been an incredibly successful program that's provided education and provided a high school diploma for many of these students when they would have been lost to the system otherwise.
Dr. Michael Barber, thank you. Dr. Barber is a professor of instructional design for the College and Education Health Services at Touro University in California. Thank you for joining us on Teacher Talk. Dr. Barber, please come back.
Teacher Talk is sponsored by Weather Wonder Incorporated, an early learning science advocate. For more information, log on to lisamoser.com. And if you would like to participate in an upcoming show, click on to the Teacher Talk blog for details. Now back to Teacher Talk.
Let's go to our next caller.
Today we are discussing a sensitive issue in education, and each of our guests bring considerable expertise on policies relating to education and student populations. On the phone with me is Sally Riddle. Sally, are you there?
I am.
Thank you so much for joining us on Teacher Talk. Can you share some of the things that you're involved in at this time?
There's two organizations that I'm working with under a COB Smart Justice umbrella, where we work with community police relations, particularly in relationship to differential policing for people of color. And the other is the Smart Justice School-to-Prison Pipeline Coalition.
From school to prison. It's a very sensitive topic.
There are multiple facets contributing to it, and I think some of it is school policy, some of it is law enforcement techniques, some of it is education needed for our educators around implicit bias and differential expectations of students, often based on race.
I see this pipeline only from one end. I'm not out in the community per se as much as I am in the classroom. And so as a teacher, I'm very concerned about some of the behavior that does seem problematic. And it looks to me as if some of these things could be corrected early on. I don't understand why we don't seem to catch some of this, why we're not trying to intervene earlier on. Are there programs out there that maybe I just don't know about?
Well, I'm not as knowledgeable as far as how some of the different school districts are handling early disciplinary problems. However, I do think that things have changed from when I was in school, or even my son, who's now in his 30s, was in school, in that many disciplinary problems were handled internally within the school, often by the principal at earlier levels and the assistant principal at the high school level. And students were not as so quickly expelled or suspended. And we do know that suspensions and expelling students increases significantly the risk of ending up in the criminal justice system, because we do know that education is one of the biggest deterrents to ending up in the criminal justice system. So when we have a kindergartner getting expelled, this is something that just did not happen. Yes,
kindergarten.
Yes, kindergarten. And the other part of it is working with families to be able to help with behaviors as well. But I also believe that often teachers are not getting the support they need as far as ongoing training, for example, with classroom control. And so consequently, now that we have school resource officers in the schools, they are getting called into situations that if the teacher had better support with ongoing continuing education and mentoring and classroom control probably would not be necessary. And school resource officers, let's not kid ourselves, they're police officers.
Correct.
And so those even are handled differently in different school systems, so that these things can be nipped in the bud instead of having the student immediately end up on a, whether in school or out of school, suspension, missing classroom time, which obviously then creates added difficulties for the student to do well in the classroom, and you end up with a downward spiral. The other change that I've seen is with zero tolerance policies over small infractions being treated as though they're major issues. And while I recognize that some of these zero tolerance policies have come about because of things like Columbine, it does mean that students who could benefit from help other than the juvenile justice system end up getting thrown out of the school for their and losing that support system.
And I'm looking at the average classroom. You know, you've got five, maybe six classes a day. You have 30 students, maybe, if you're lucky, maybe 20 to 25. You know, a decade ago, you might have only had two or three students acting out per period, whereas now, you know, it might be closer to a third or a half of the class.
So we're going to be investigating this further. It looks like when students are sent into this alternative school, mm-hmm. it's basically just a pass-through into the criminal justice system. When we look at the percentage of students who are being referred to police and law enforcement, and it is largely children of color.
Sally Riddle, advocating for our Georgia communities. Sally, please phone in and share with us again soon. Our topic today is the school-to-prison pipeline. Next, we talk with an educator and a parent, and we are sharing more details on this very sensitive topic, a topic that is especially impacting the African-American communities. But first, let me lighten up the conversation somewhat today, remembering what it was like when we were in school, a different time. I'm going to reach out and have this conversation with someone that is a colleague.
I have a very special caller on the line. Welcome to Teacher Talk, Van Tate. Van, how are you?
I am just wonderful. How are you doing, Lisa?
I'm good. I want to share with my audience that you and I know each other from a ways back. But before we get into that, let me just make sure that everyone knows that you are a sportscaster, well-known in your area, and that you have extensive experience in broadcasting in the studio as well as on the field. Where you are right now?
Albuquerque, New Mexico. Everybody's always talking about Santa Fe, so we're about 45 minutes from Santa Fe, but it's the biggest city in New Mexico, Albuquerque is.
And you've been there for a couple of decades?
Yeah, 26 years now.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
I want to take you back. What were you like as a student? Did you get into trouble? But more importantly, was there something that you remember that a teacher told you, good or bad?
Well, you know, back in middle school, I was always kind of like a curious guy. Always, I didn't get into trouble, but I was very curious. So I was always looking, snooping around. When I first got into high school, I had one teacher named Miss Dillinger who thought I was creative instead of going like, oh, well, we got to make him be quiet and be just like every student in the room, you know. And she left an impression on me because she was just always wanting me to be who I was because she used to laugh and she thought I was so funny and creative that she, you know, it was a change for me, you know, as far as them teachers being mad at me or something like that. She was always like she encouraged my creativity.
That's interesting for you to say. Not every student is comfortable sitting at the traditional desk and the book text kind of learning. You were different in that area?
Yes. It was always I was always you know, I couldn't sit still that well, you know. You know, sometimes it would even drive my mom crazy that, you know, can you just sit still for a minute? Backgrounds, you know, like there's people that don't realize that that's really a ticket out of this situation for some people. It's not all of them, you know, like there's people who have mom and dad and a really good, steady, stable life, and they're just, you know, a normal life. But then there's other people who don't have that at home. They don't have, they might have a mother and she might be whacked out or whatever, and the aunt helped him to get to school, and they're just trying to make all of this work because they see he has a way out. So you meet all kind of different people from all different backgrounds. But the thing I like about sports is that you pour all those different backgrounds into one pot, and everybody gets to learn together, you know, like from somebody else's experience. Get to not stereotype people, just get to know them as a person, and it's better for all of us. You know what I mean?
Well, when you say all of us, let me ask you this, because, you know, coming up, the male gender was better supported in the sports arena.
There's a lot of opportunities for young ladies now because of Title IX, and you know, like women even playing basketball. You know, you have the WNBA, but beyond that, you also have overseas, which is where some of the players I know are currently playing overseas. And then they have different things, too, like women who want to use their looks and they want to play sports. Like, there's actually a team in L.A. called the Basketball Beauties.
let me back you up just a second, because you did mention the Title IX legislation, and I want to make sure that we clarify on how that funding is spreaded out so that women do have more opportunity. Could you elaborate more on Title IX?
Yeah, it's just basically makes it where you have to have, if you're going to have 10 guy sports, you need to have 10 women's sports. You know, you got to, there's got to be equity, you know, between the two, gender equity. You know, like, there's got to be the same amount of clubs, the opportunities for the women as the guys.
Van Tate, thank you. Hello to everyone in Albuquerque. I know they love you. I have to get to this next call. She is a parent and an educator, Dr. McCleskey.
She is an educator. She is a voice in her community.
I honestly did not realize how significant, I guess I could say, a problem that we were having in regards to the school to prison pipeline until I started teaching in the elementary schools. And I think that's because when you're teaching high school and middle school, where I was primarily teaching before I moved to Rome, Georgia, I did not witness the beginnings of the pipeline. I guess the introduction to the pipeline. I didn't witness it then. So it wasn't until I got into the elementary schools and started teaching at elementary school that it became very vivid to me how this was occurring. And a lot of it has to do with discipline. Our kids are not being disciplined anymore. And that's why we're having such an increase in this school-to-prison pipeline, because there is literally very little structure in these elementary schools. Well, I could honestly say the elementary school that I was teaching in, and also the elementary school that my son, who could have possibly been a victim of this school-to-prison pipeline had I not intervened, and I am, of course, an educator. So for me, I recognize that, hey, this is not going in the right direction. When my son was in kindergarten, our house is structured. I provide structure. You know, I'm a teacher. And my students will tell you that I am very structured. I'm also very caring, which is something that all teachers really must be. Before anything, you need to care. So with my son, when my son started kindergarten, it was a hard transition for him. And a lot of people don't understand. It's a little different for black males than it is black females. My daughters, I never had a problem with them in school, ever. They won awards for behaving. They always excelled academically. So it was a shock to me when my son started kindergarten and we were having all these behavior problems. My son would literally go to school Monday, Tuesday, and be suspended Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. And this is a kindergarten.
In kindergarten. Now, I've not experienced that. Let me just interject here for just a moment, because I've not experienced that. However, I am aware that, and I was surprised by it, because I've known for a number of years that you've had to have more security, more campus police in schools, especially for high school. Now it's in middle school, and as I understand it, not all, but they are patrolling many elementary schools.
Exactly, and that's what I was saying. I have primarily taught middle school and high school. So when I went down to the elementary level, I was shocked. I said, I just couldn't believe it. I was just amazed to see elementary kids, like kindergarten, first grade, second graders, and they pretty much were making decisions that children should not have the right to make. They'd walk out of class when they felt like it. They would be very disrespectful to the teachers when they felt like it.
And I do want to touch on your book.
It's on stepping out on faith, saying goodbye to public education after 19 years.
I've had parents, not all, but I've had some parents who really aren't aware of how their child or children behave in school. And they're in disbelief when I'm documenting all of the shenanigans that are going on in the classroom. Some of them are really in disbelief. Are you surprised by that?
No, because I would have been one of those parents. There are a lot of parents who are in denial. They won't help the school, and that's why schools are so reluctant to reach out to parents, because you have parents who will come out there and want to curse the teacher out, and they are totally in denial. But what they don't understand, our kids are kids, and kids have realized that I'm at school. These people at school do not have the same power that my parents do in the house. And they're taking advantage of that situation.
They really do in many instances.
They take advantage.
Dr. McCluskey, thank you. Thank everyone that called in. Researcher and online expert, Dr. Michael Barber, community voice, Sally Riddle, thank you. And sportscaster, Van Tate, thank you. And thank you for listening. This is Teacher Talk.
Teacher Talk.